Good morning, friends. I'm going to read Matthew chapter 18, verses 1 through 6, and you will find that if you want to read along in the Pew Bibles, you'll find that on page 26 in the New Testament section, which is in the back. Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew chapter 18, verses 1 through 6. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called a child to himself and set him before them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. She is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea." We'll let Harper and Sebastian and Cassidy go downstairs. And any other kids that want to come? I'm one of those annoying people who likes to point out grammar and spelling errors in public signage. Perhaps some of you enjoy doing this too. Anybody else? Okay. Quakers are generally wordsmiths, so, you know, there's going to be one or two in the crowd. Missing apostrophes and apostrophes where they don't belong, Stephanie knows, are my pet peeve in particular. But there's lots of other fun stuff. Spellings that result in unfortunate double entendres or some other meaning from widely divergent from what was likely intended. Bizarre non sequiturs, et cetera, et cetera. I love it. And there are a few instances of this phenomenon that I still remember from the streets of Chicago, where Stephanie and I lived for many years. One of them was from the facade of a liquor store on the city's northwest side. The name of the store was Non-Better Liquors. Non-Better Liquors. I'm pretty sure they meant to call the place None Better, and they forgot the E. I think that's what happened. I used to dream up advertising campaigns for this place, you know. None better. We're a pretty good store. We're not any better than any of the rest, but we're not any worse either. We're none better. The second instance was similar. Around the corner from the second apartment where we lived after we were married, there was a small storefront which boasted the name Decent Convenient Store. We always thought they could be a little more assertive, right? It's great that you're convenient, we appreciate that, but are you really sure you're just decent? Shouldn't you be awesome or great or something instead? Now, I realize it's easy to be a critic, especially for a privileged and overeducated white man like me. And it's likely that one or both of these Chicago businesses was probably run by immigrant families for whom English was the second or third or fourth language. So I don't mention these things in a mean spirit. A big part of the reason that Non-Better Liquors and Decent Convenience Store were funny to me and also poignant is that they've given the lie to the game that virtually our entire society plays. Due to some easy-to-make spelling and usage errors, they've failed at maintaining the public pretense to greatness, a pretense that almost all of us are taught from early on that we must maintain. In our place and time, pretension to greatness is all around us. Each advertisement that comes on the radio or the TV or across the screen of your smartphone is a presentation of just how great their particular product is and how much greater it is than any of those others. That's how you play the game. Each of our presidential candidates is in the nearly constant habit of asserting how great things will be if they can secure the White House by means of our votes. And yes, I know that there's one of them in particular who's, for whom that is the nearly constant refrain. But they all are doing it. Some are just more subtle, I think, than him. But that's how you play the game, whether you're obvious or subtle. The public pretension to greatness. So that's the reason that non-better liquors and the decent convenience store stick in my memory. They've tripped up this game. The truth is, that liquor store probably is just about the same as any other store that sells the stuff that it sells on the northwest side of Chicago. And the same goes for that convenience store. No fault of theirs, it's just the way things are. But most of the rest of the crowd is better at the game of pretended greatness. And Jesus' disciples also played this game. Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? In other places in the Gospels, their pretensions are a bit closer to the surface, right? In one place, Jesus actually catches them arguing about which one would be the greatest. In another, James and John come to him asking that they be given the seats on either side of his throne when his kingdom comes. So here they may be trying to be a little slick, right? Oh, Jesus, by the way, not that it matters, but who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? It would not be surprising to know that the question they really want answered is, which of us is the greatest? And as usual, Jesus does not answer them directly. I suppose he could have just said, well, I'm the greatest, of course, you bunch of mopes. Why do you think you're following me and I'm not following you? But of course, there's always more to it. He chooses to give them a visual example, to act out a kind of parable in miniature. He calls a child to him and sets him up in the midst of the crowd of disciples. Right there, before he said anything further, Jesus has done something significant. Where did that child come from, I wonder? Because if you think about the people around him, that child was not close by, probably. Jesus is in the center of the crowd, as the Gospels tell us he always, almost always was, except when he went off to pray by himself. He's surrounded by his inner circle, this group of mostly men at this point who want to know who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Then beyond that, there are others interested in learning from him, but maybe not so sure. There are those that need healing of some sort, who are desperate to get through this bunch of disciples if they would just part way. Then beyond them, the curious, his opponents, the scribes and the Pharisees, perhaps some soldiers to keep the peace. And then somewhere, maybe even further out than that, women and children. Why? Because that was their place in that day and age. We know certainly that there were women close to Jesus and close around Jesus at certain points, but by and large, women and children were some of the most marginalized people, the ones who had the least power. In Greek and Roman society, at least, they were not regarded as much better than property. And there was no concept of rights as we think of them today. Excuse me. So Jesus makes a symbolic gesture, again, a sort of visual parable, by calling out to the margins and bringing a child into the center, reversing the expectations that the powers of the day set for everyone. Everyone had their place. And a child in the center was not usual. And he tells the disciples, here's your example of greatness right here. To be great in the kingdom, you need to become like this child. You need to be converted, he says, to humility. A lot of times when we read passages like this, when Jesus interacts with children, there's a tendency to think, oh, Jesus knew how wonderful children were, and if we could all just be a bit more childlike, well, we would all be a bit closer to the kingdom. That's what Jesus is trying to tell us here. Now, it's true. There are many childlike characteristics that all of us who would live in the kingdom should seek after. And you can enumerate lots of them, I'm sure. Children are innocent, they're playful, they're teachable, they're full of wonder. There's lots more. And so should we be. But we also know that children can be self-centered, competitive, petulant, unable to control themselves. You can doubtless think of more, right? So there's more that Jesus is trying to show here. And we have to consider one thing he says in particular, I think. Whoever then humbles him or herself as this child, he or she is the greatest in the kingdom. So the call to the kingdom is the call to humble oneself. Now for us, in our day and age and social position, the social position that many of us hold, I think, humility is mostly an inner characteristic. It's a personality trait or the way that someone carries themselves in the world. In Jesus' context, and especially in the action that he takes of bringing the child to the center from the margins, humility had to do with marginalization and vulnerability. Becoming humble as a child meant, in part, to become a marginalized one, to move out of the center, if you were put there by society, and to be vulnerable, to be willing to lay down status and station, to give the lie to all of your pretensions to greatness, to become like the poor in spirit and the meek of the Beatitudes, the ones whom Jesus says are blessed, despite what the world says. This would not have been an easy word for the disciples if they understood it the way that I think Jesus was trying to say it, nor should it be an easy word for us. Receiving the kingdom also involves our vulnerability and our humility. We are unable to enter the reign of God when we are in our own strength, moving at our own speed, ticking off items on our own agenda, concerned for our own prerogatives and perquisites, keeping up all of our pretensions to greatness. In seeking the kingdom, we must lay those things aside and move ourselves out of the center. And part of receiving the kingdom, Jesus goes on to say, means receiving those whom Jesus has already identified as being part of it. So receiving the kingdom means receiving the poor, the meek, those who mourn, the ones who have been pushed to the margins. In some sense, they may be there before we are, before some of us are, at any rate. We may find ourselves the guests of the marginalized in seeking to be part of the kingdom. Part of receiving the kingdom means welcoming children, which we're going to do today. And also with the understanding that our children don't have everything they need to be part of the kingdom either. And that's where we ended this passage. The importance of receiving those and not hindering those who are coming in to the kingdom. Receiving a child in Jesus' name, receiving one of the meek in Jesus' name, receiving the poor in spirit in Jesus' name, and dropping our own pretensions to greatness so that when we find ourselves received by those people, we recognize it for the gift that it is.